Good morning, everyone. Good morning. I'll begin by saying that your eyes do not deceive you. I'm not Martha Tremblay, but I'm happy to fill in for her. I believe she's on vacation, I hope. It looks like we are just short of a quorum. However, we will have our administrative director, Luke Ginger, read through roll call.
Thank you, Acting Chair. Give me one moment while I share my screen and we will do roll call. There is only one item to vote on today. Most of our items are going to be informational, just so everyone is aware. Okay, the roll should appear on the screen any minute now. I'll call your names in alphabetical order. Sabrina Ashtian.
Here. Good morning.
Cody Bridges.
Here.
And sorry, I forgot to mention, if you'd like to state your affiliation, please do so. Edward Caldwell.
Present. Representing West Basin Municipal Water District.
Laura Doss-Hertz. Dean Francois.
I'm here, Hermosa Beach City Council member representing the South Bay Council of Governments.
Will Dittinger.
Here, Captain, Los Angeles County Fire Department, Lifeguard Division, representing Public Safety.
Jenny Newman.
Here, representing Cali, PA.
Carrie Nichols.
Present, representing Hilda Bay.
David Peterson.
Here, representing Las Virgenes Municipal Water District.
Lauren Pizer-Mains. No. Michael Quill.
Present, representing Los Angeles Waterkeeper.
Greg Rochal.
Present, representing Black Surfers Collective.
Jasmine Reinhardt.
Present, representing the Santa Monica Mountains Resource Conservation District.
Bertha Ruiz Hoffman.
Present, representing LA County Beaches and Harbors.
Josh Westfall.
Present, representing Los Angeles County Sanitation Districts.
Aaron Wilson.
Present, representing Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Aaron Ordauer.
Present, representing Los Angeles County Supervisor Lindsay Horvath.
Laura Doss-Hertz.
Present, representing the Board of the Bay Foundation.
Let me check online. Erica Yelensky.
Good morning, everyone. Erica Yelensky with U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, Region 9. And I just wanted to make a note for AGP. On the Zoom, it says you are in a practice session. So if that matters for recording, then you can change that. It also kind of blocks a big part of the screen. Ah, you started the webinar. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Erica. Tina O.
Hi, Tina O. with the City of Los Angeles, joining virtually.
Thank you, Tina. And Tom Ford.
Tom Ford, present, Director, Santa Monica Bay National Estuary Program.
Are there any members that I missed in roll call, either online or in the room? Okay, if not, I will go over some meeting procedures. Give me one moment while I pull up my notes. So we are grateful to have the Delray Yacht Club host us, and we are grateful to have AGP Video providing audio-visual support. Restrooms are located down the hall if you go out the door here and take a left. Also, please help yourself to some refreshments in the back behind the podium there. If you need Wi-Fi, the network is DRYC_clubhouse, and the password is Palawan1108. That is capital P, Alawan 1108. The meeting is in a hybrid format in which members and the public are participating both remotely and in person. For remote participants, if you need technical support for the Zoom meeting, please email it@agpvideo.com. The email is also provided in the agenda. Now I'll provide some information about public participation. You must be in the room or on Zoom to make public comment. Members of the public may request a comment in the following ways. If you are in person, fill out a speaker card located by the door on the table there. And if you are participating via Zoom, you can raise your hand virtually when we reach the item under which you'd like to speak. The raise hand function is at the bottom of your screen on the Zoom app. If you're calling in over the phone, dial *9 to raise your hand and *6 to unmute yourself. The meeting is being recorded and live streamed, so we ask that you please speak clearly. And please remember to turn on your microphone when you speak and turn it off when you finish speaking. So that applies to the folks in the room. And that concludes the overview of meeting logistics. I recommend we move on with the rest of the agenda.
Thank you, Luke. That brings us to agenda item number one, comments from members of the public on items not on the agenda. It's important to note that all public comment on items not on the agenda, information items on the agenda, and public testimony on action items will be limited to a combined total of no more than 4 minutes. So with that, my understanding is that we do have two requests for public comment.
That is correct. Our first commenter is in the room with us, Mitchell. Please step up to the podium. And can we have a timer for 4 minutes, please?
It's on now, I guess.
It's on now.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Right now, as you know, the ocean has been storming and waves coming in, crashing. We've lost, what I'm getting at is the scientists are saying the ocean's rising. We've seen houses along Broad Beach disappear, various places along the beach, berms. The waves have been cutting away berms at the edge of the wave action, berms that you wouldn't see this time of the year. I see it. I live around there. I see it. It's never been happening. Now, getting back to the Malibu burnouts along the coast, I've spoken on this before. This is a golden opportunity. These people are lost their homes, and a lot of them can't afford to rebuild. This is the time to initiate at least a study on taking it over for the state, and the county. We need. I speak for we, the public. The beaches are inundated, crowded. And you see it going up the coast highway, bumper to bumper, looking for a beach to go to. So I request this committee at least do a study on having the county and the state take it over. You know, that property was originally, as you probably know, owned by the Adamsons family, the Ringe family. And the state wanted to take it, and they took it. One of the reasons going before the Supreme Court was on the beauty of the coastline. And they got the road, but the land on either side belonged to the privates, and it got sold. But now, because of the ocean rising, and you know the scientists are saying this, and a couple of Malibu City Council people have been questioning whether or not we should rebuild, but the scientists are saying don't. So I think there's enough substance for this committee on environmental to get on the ball and start looking at least discussing to take possible giving that coastal beach land over to the public. Thank you very much. I want to say one thing. You people here are leadership, and the initiation has to come out of you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mitchell. We have one more public comment. It was submitted as a written comment, so I will read it aloud. Could I please have a timer of 4 minutes so I can track the time on this? Thank you. So this was a statement submitted by Walter Lamb of the Biona Wetlands Land Trust. Comment is, the Biona Wetlands Land Trust has submitted these written comments with the hopes that they can be read into the record at the Santa Monica Bay Restoration Commission's June 18th meeting. The Land Trust would like to note that it has been 2.5 years since Senator Ben Allen attended the December 2023 meeting and requested an update on the Biona Wetlands Restoration Project, and it has been 2 years since CDFW provided an update on that project in June of 2024. All of the estimated timeline dates presented in those meetings have been missed. Likewise, the milestones of publishing a draft revised EIR by May of this year has been missed. However, this is still likely to be the last board meeting at which members can direct staff to provide comments on the draft revised EIR that is due to be published imminently. The Commission adopted a resolution in 2010 pledging to remain involved in the planning process for the restoration of the Biona Wetlands until that process was complete. So it is appropriate for the governing board to direct staff to provide comments on the draft EIR, especially as it relates to issues like achieving the numeric targets of the total maximum daily loads. Thank you. That is a statement from Walter Lamb, Biona Wetlands Land Trust. Those are all the public comments we have. Unless there are folks online, you have an opportunity to raise your hands. I don't see any hands raised online. However, for the purposes of roll call, I would like to note that Lauren Salisbury and Laurel Wardrip are attending the meeting remotely.
Thank you, Luke. That brings us to agenda item number 2, our information items. Item 2A is the order of the agenda. My understanding is that staff has no proposed changes to the agenda.
To make a suggestion, move that we adjust the order of the agenda and have our presentations first from our guests and then deal with the business afterwards.
Since we don't have quorum, we cannot vote today, so
can you just arrange that, Luke, because Pondelli gets really upset if he has to stick around too long. I'm just saying, you know, we can do a lot of stuff after the presentations, and if we can't do that, we can't do that, but I'd suggest that
we can just do that without voting on it. We don't have a quorum anyway, right?
Correct. That's my understanding, is that at the discretion of the chair, we're able to do that. And so we will do that. We'll handle those presentations at the beginning of this meeting. Are there any other recommendations to the changes to the agenda? Seeing none. Then let's move to the presentations. And if I could have Luke introduce those items.
I'm sorry, just for a point of clarification, is the recommendation to put items under, so 4A, 4B, and 4C before 2B, 2C, 2D, and 2E?
Yes, Luke, that's what I'm thinking.
Okay.
Right?
Okay. Just needed to clarify. Thank you.
Okay. So that brings us to item 4A, presentation on resolution 26-02. And if I could have Luke introduce this item.
Thank you, Chair. I have some slides that I will present. So please give me a moment while I pull those up. Okay, the slides should show up. For everyone in the room, I'd also like to note that Lauren Pizer-Mains has is now in the meeting. She's back there. So today, this is just a presentation on this resolution. This will not be brought for a vote. It is just for discussion and consideration. So resolution 2602, reaffirming support for disadvantaged communities and work related to climate change. I'll review the background on this resolution as well as walk you through the a summary of the contents of the resolution and the provisions provided in this resolution. So I'll start with the mission of the SMBRC. The mission is to restore and enhance Santa Monica Bay through actions and partnerships. Our mission is to improve water quality, conserve natural resources, mitigate impacts of climate change, and protect the bay's ecological, cultural, and economic values. So it's always important to keep our mission in our sights as we discuss things like this. So when it comes to disadvantaged communities in Santa Monica Bay, these communities face higher exposure to pollution, a higher amount of environmental degradation, fewer parks and open spaces, and a reduced ability to mitigate against heat, flooding, and other climate impacts. So these communities are particularly vulnerable to the impacts of climate change, which I will review here. So as the climate changes in Santa Monica Bay, we can expect an increased frequency and intensity of extreme weather events, wildfires, drought, flooding, and sea level rise. And these disadvantaged communities in Santa Monica Bay must be provided meaningful benefits from the work that we do. So that's restoration work, habitat enhancement, and water quality improvement. So the disadvantaged communities in Santa Monica Bay are more vulnerable to the climate impacts, and therefore we have a responsibility to ensure that the work we do helps protect those communities against these impacts. So commission staff created this draft resolution, again, for purposes of discussion here. And in this resolution, commission staff proposed that we reaffirm our commitments to protecting beneficial uses in disadvantaged communities. I recommend that we commit to integrating racial equity and environmental justice principles into commission work. I recommend that we reaffirm commitments to actions addressing climate change, as well as support policies, investments, and collaborations that will continue to address impacts of climate change. This resolution was provided to you more than 10 days before this meeting. I hope many of you had the chance to review it and take a look at it. There will be time to review and submit comments to me before it is brought to a vote. This is just the first discussion we'll have on it. We also have an executive committee meeting that is scheduled for next month where further discussion can take place. So that being said, I'm happy to answer more questions about the contents of the resolution. I could display the resolution, and I also recommend that we have a discussion about its provisions.
Are there any comments in relation to resolution 2602? Yes.
I was just wanting to get some clarification on the discussion of, is the climate change piece through the lens of thinking about disadvantaged communities? Because I noticed that if it's more broadly about climate change in Santa Monica Bay, it didn't mention ocean acidification or hypoxia or marine heat waves or, you know, specific, I think, climate change burdens on marine ecosystems. So I just wanted to see if that was intentional or if we should add that in somewhere.
No, not intentional. I'm sorry if there was something missing there that you think needs to be added. Do you mind expanding on that a little bit?
Well, there's a part that like lists out some of the climate change impacts for the Bay, but it seems like they're more the kind of terrestrial impacts potentially. I mean, it does mention sea level rise. So I'm just, if we want to be more inclusive of some of the climate change impacts, then I think it's important to add those in.
Thank you. If you give me a moment, I think it might be helpful if I display the actual resolution.
And yeah, and I think it's the 1, 2, 3, the fifth whereas.
Fifth whereas.
Third from the bottom on page one.
Great, thank you. Yeah. Let me share my screen. Could I get my screen displayed once I share it?
But again, I think that part does kind of focus on the lens of disproportionately affecting communities. And so I could see that, like, maybe those things don't necessarily need to go in that section. But so we might think about adding another piece that's about, the effects of climate change on ecosystems or ocean resources, et cetera.
Okay, so add more about impacts of climate change. And then what's missing is ocean acidification in particular?
Yeah, ocean acidification, hypoxia. I don't know if we want to call out the difference between, like, marine heat waves and terrestrial heat waves. I mean, they kind of manifest differently, and marine heat waves tend to be more prolonged.
Okay, great, thank you.
And I do have a question after you.
Yes.
Yeah, so just to kind of continue off of that, I wonder if the intention of this is to, or because the title says reaffirming support for disadvantaged communities and work related to climate change. We know that those things are not in silos. We know that there's a nexus between them. Just the "and work," it makes me think, like, should this actually be two separate things? One that focuses on environmental justice related to disadvantaged communities, and then one more specifically focused on climate change? Because right now this is trying to do two things. Mm-hmm. And by doing two things, it's missing some of the critical components related to climate change specifically. So just a recommendation.
Great point.
Thank you. Maybe split it into two resolutions?
Yes.
Okay. Any thoughts on that?
I have a question. What's the purpose of this, and where is it going?
If I could just add one comment, because this has been an ongoing conversation here at the Santa Monica Bay Restoration Commission. And I would just say that I wouldn't call it debate, but deep thoughts, deep comments about the importance of the words that we use. Having been a part of the Santa Monica Bay Restoration Commission for a number of years, I know that in the early stages, it was difficult to incorporate and utilize language, including disadvantaged community and climate change. And I won't say that there's been an effort recently to kind of scrub those documents, but it looks like that's what's happened. And I think our individual agencies have seen that. I think we see that here. And so as we've done it, me personally, and I represent West Basin Municipal Water District Director Gloria Gray, it's been uncomfortable for us. We know the effort that went into incorporating these words and the language in the past. And so though we have removed a lot of those specific words and terms from our documents, I think there's an effort that needs to be made to highlight the importance of the work that we're doing and why we're doing it. And then I'll hand it off to Luke to maybe comment.
EJ summed it up pretty well. The fact that certain documents that we've had to submit to the US EPA have had to take a certain form over the last year and a half now. This idea sprouted from that, ensuring that our focus is not lost and our values are not lost.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That's a great explanation.
Hi. I just wanted to weigh in on in supporting the idea of breaking this out into two separate resos. I do think that's a great idea to focus on each of these to issues that we want to uplift, both the climate change and our work with supporting and acknowledging the impacts on disadvantaged communities.
Thank you. That's very helpful. Sabrina?
Thank you for drafting this, and agreed that this is a conversation that we've been having for a few months, so it's nice to see this coming to fruition. I agree with the idea of either breaking this into two separate resolutions or perhaps eliminating the phrase "and work" so that it would be support for disadvantaged communities related to climate change, because otherwise I agree with the comments that are being made that there's so much involved with the work that we're doing for climate change, and we can't sum it up here. So I think either two resolutions or changing the headlines or the title so that it just relates to disadvantaged communities and how they're experiencing climate change, if that's helpful. I can also write that if that's more helpful. Thank you.
Yeah, and I'll just add, again, this is we can have a discussion in here. Members are welcome to submit written comments to me or a marked up version of this. For the folks supporting two resolutions, what do you think of Sabrina's recommendation?
This is Jasmine from Santa Monica RCD. Are you talking about the eliminating the "and"?
Yeah, the recommendation is adapting this resolution displayed here in order to support both issues that you were saying needed to be addressed by two resolutions. You know, could this be adapted to fill all needs?
Oh,
or meet all needs?
Well, it all, I mean, possibly, but I think it all starts with the, what are we trying to accomplish? So really thinking about what are we trying to accomplish, and if the sole focus right now is on the impact of climate change to disadvantaged communities, that could be one, right? But if as a commission we also hold true in the effects of climate change to our ecosystems, then, which I believe we do, then that I would recommend merits its own if it doesn't already exist. But that's just my two cents.
Yeah, I also think that we should consider the two resolution option, because there are other ways in which the commission supports and intends to support the disadvantaged communities, not just with climate change, but with other projects that are approved. So that's where I'm at. I think there's a lot in each bucket. And I also forgot to add that I wanted to just acknowledge staff and that we have so far is very well written. So thank you.
Thank you. It seems like since there's support for two resolutions, we could always do that. I recommend I could draft two resolutions and bring that to the executive committee, bring both to the executive committee for further discussion. Does that sound like a good path forward for folks? So I could do that, but I'd also like to continue discussing the content of this resolution here.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. I appreciate the desire to have two separate, but, and like you said, you're going to present both one combined and two separate ones if you want at the executive committee. And of course, we don't have a quorum. We can't vote on anything here. But, you know, my feeling is that I think it's great the way it's integrated together. It represents what we're doing here at the commission and the Santa Monica Bay and the environment. And, you know, we're just open to more criticism if we separate it into two. And we should, I'd like to just move this. I think we tend to get caught up too much in creating all these resolutions that for the sake of something on a piece of paper instead of really being action oriented and doing things. And, you know, I like it the way it is. And some work went into it. And so that's my feeling on that. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any further comments? Yes.
Yes, and you know, not the sharpest knife in the drawer, but just it's kind of seeping in, and probably need to reflect on it a little bit longer, maybe make a suggestion. But I mean, just the frustrating world that I've been dealing with environmental justice and the climate, having them being separated and trying to do both at the same time, nothing gets done. So I mean, there's an effort. It shouldn't be, but we almost have to separate them to deal with it. I mean, we are talking about a community that's divided, and then we're going to deal with it in a divided way. So I don't know how to change the language, but I know that the systemic oppression that's going on continues, and I think maybe that needs its own focus with the climate on top of it. I mean, there, you know. So I wasn't up for two, but I think maybe separating it can give us a little more clarity, because it's a quagmire of craziness in the other areas I'm working with. So maybe I should have waited.
Yeah. Thank you. Correct. I was going to go through the commission first. Okay. Go ahead.
I'll just briefly chime in, and again, appreciation to staff for drafting this. It really, I think, meets the spirit of what this body has requested and we're all grappling with. I really liked Carrie's recommendation about the specific, sort of the language as is has, you know, the basic, these are the major, you know, challenges that climate change is bringing on all of our communities. I liked Carrie's addition because of it makes it a little closer to the specific types of projects and work that we do with this commission here. And I would just ask that in the same vein, if there's going to be a separate resolution around equity, racial justice, that we also just think about a couple of the ways that we are, you know, some of the examples that are lifted up of why this is relevant to the work of this commission, bringing community stakeholders into environmental and ocean stewardship, making sure that there's equitable access to recreational opportunities, and you know, I'm more thoughtful people in this room will have better examples of that. But there's certainly a breadth of good examples, workforce, and bringing more people into doing that. So, but I don't have a strong opinion about two versus one, but I think that that would be a helpful way to again make sure it's clear why this matters to the work we do.
Thank you. I think we've got some very specific feedback for staff. Are there any final comments? Because we do have one public comment from Mr. Walter Lamb that would be read into the record as well. Seeing no additional comment here.
Great. And I'll just mention I will draft two separate resolutions and bring those to the executive committee. If anyone here would like to submit comments to me on the resolution as it was presented here today, our executive committee meeting is on July 16th, but because staff will need some time to organize your thoughts and put them into a document, I ask that you get me your comments by the second week of July, so before the 16th, please. Now I will read a comment from Walter Lamb on this item. Could I please have a timer for 2 minutes and 11 seconds, please? Give me one moment. Here we go. Thank you. You could start it. The Biona Wetlands Land Trust has submitted these written comments with the hope that they can be read into the record at the Santa Monica Bay Restoration Commission's June 18th meeting. The Land Trust strongly supports adoption of a resolution to reaffirm the Commission's commitment to addressing climate change and environmental justice. We respectfully urge the Commission not to weaken or dilute the well-thought-out language that has been drafted by staff. The Land Trust believes that the draft resolution could be further strengthened by directly referencing the Commission's commitment to tribal engagement. That concludes the statement.
Thank you, Luke. Are there any final comments before we move on? Seeing none,
Then that brings us to item 4B under the additional information items. It's a presentation on the Rocky Reef State of the Bay chapter, and we'll have Luke present this item.
Thank you, Chair. So in 2021, the SMBRC Governing Board approved over $3 million, I believe it was $3.4 million, in Prop 50 funding for six different projects that advanced the Commission's mission. The first project to finish was SCORP, who provided a presentation on their Wetlands State of the Bay chapter at the last meeting. The second study that is wrapping up is our TAC Chair Dan Pondella's project, assessing the condition of rocky reef habitats around Santa Monica Bay. So that chapter is being finalized as we speak, and we are very close to having two of our State of the Bay chapters done. So Dan, if you are ready, I can share your slides. All right, give me one moment, everyone. Okay, Dan, once it's displayed on the screen, feel free to begin.
Thanks, Luke. So I'm going to give an update on our work on the Rocky Reefs in Santa Monica Bay, but it says 2023 to 2025, but you'll see that we've been working on this for multi-decades, and some of that data will come through in the presentation. Next slide, please. So historically and currently, the reefs in the bay, especially along the Palos Verdes Peninsula, are suffering from landslides and associated sedimentation turbidity impacts. This is ongoing. The picture on the left is when Portuguese Bend was moving, and the picture on right is kind of the current day status. So what happens with these landslides is the sediment goes into the nearshore environment, and then it just persists there for literally decades. Next slide, please. We have noted during the last study period that there's been a number of new landslides on the peninsula. All of these have been associated with upland processes. So this is Palos Verdes, and the slide started at the top of the homeowner's property and is moving into the nearshore environment. This is actually a picture of a habitat that the Bay Foundation restored. So we have the sedimentation was going into this nearshore habitat. It went in for a while. It got stopped, fortunately, and then the habitat suffered for a brief period of time and then came back. You could see the kelp returned, and this is Tom's group's work. But these issues are continuing to be ongoing. We've noted other slides in the Palos Verdes Peninsula over this period, and the issue, as I mentioned, of sedimentation or turbidity causes some significant impacts, even in our marine protected area. Next slide, please. We designed and built a 87-acre restoration habitat off of Bunker Point, and I'll talk about some of the outputs from this project later. But so there's been two major restoration projects on the Palos Verdes Peninsula. This one, the Palos Verdes Reef, is the largest rocky reef restoration project in the state's history. And then next slide. In coordination with that is the Bay Foundation's kelp restoration project, where they've restored an additional 71.5 acres. So we're talking about 160 acres-ish of habitat restored, and really kind of leading the state in terms of these types of activities and these types of lessons learned on how to manage our nearshore resources. Next slide, please. So we started this current study in 2024. Little did we know that this is a picture of the Woolsey Fire in 2018, as we all remember. At this time, and still to this day, this is the most dramatic fire in terms of scale and scope that we've ever experienced in Los Angeles County. And that's through all written and oral history. 151 square miles burned in our watersheds. And even in 2018, 2019, we've been monitoring reefs this whole time, thought we didn't realize that this had an impact on the marine environment. Next slide, please. So on the left is a picture from 2022. We're doing our marine protected area monitoring for the state. So we work in the Point Dune Marine Reserve and the surrounding areas. And in 2022, in the marine protected area, we start seeing ash and charcoal debris from the fire. And this is actually just a note from my field notes saying, oh, look, there's some charcoal on the water. We still didn't register as that as being a problem. It's just kind of like an anecdotal note. On the right is shortly after the Palisades fire in April 2025, and you can see the same process at Big Rock and in throughout the bay. In that time, you can see the chark, the ash on the riffles of the sand below. And next slide, please. So what does this mean? Well, we didn't realize at 2018 what a big impact that was. We didn't actually realize it until we started this project, because then we started working up towards Leo Carrillo on that section of the coastline. And when I do my own field work, and when I got in the water, I was like, oh no, there's a big problem up here. Two major things we'll talk about as an example of this. Number one, this is kelp canopy. So very obvious. And on the left are the plots of kelp canopy in Malibu, the three different beds that are monitored. And you can see the red line is the 2018 fire. And then you can observe, you don't have to run stats on that. They basically go down to very low levels. Essentially 95% of the kelp canopy was gone by 2024. As an example of what should be going on the right is Palos Verdes, and kelp comes and goes, waxes and wanes with various oceanographic events, but in large part due to the restoration activities on the PV shelf, you can see it basically is stable through this entire period. So we know kelp should have been there, and we see that it is disappearing at an alarming rate, as I mentioned, 95%. This is by 2024. Next slide, please. So fire impacts is a huge deal, especially on the Malibu coastline, much larger than essentially there are no scientific papers on the effects of fire on subtidal habitats worldwide. So this is really a new phenomenon. And like I mentioned, we didn't even realize it was a problem until 6 years post impact. Probably as big, but damaging the entire ecosystem on a much larger scale is this new issue. This wasn't a problem in the last State of the Bay report. When I wrote that report, I would have said, oh, there was a bad red tide in 2005. It caused some problems, but you know, it's an episodic event. And historically, there'd been episodic red tides over the past 100 years. Not a huge concern, but certainly something to be to look at. Now, red tides are a seasonal event causing extreme shading. This is an example from King Harbor. So this is, to give you an idea of the shading process. Essentially, these red tides come in. If they persist for more than 2 or 3 weeks, they start completely shading out the benthic algae. We see loss of kelp canopy. We see loss of benthic resources associated with this. And for some, we don't know why, but this has gone from an occasional event to a every year event. And this is really damaging the ecosystem, not just Rocky Reef ecosystem, but all the subtidal ecosystems throughout the bay, kind of uniformly reducing production. So we have a shading of benthic resources. We had a delayed opening of lobster season in October 2023. This is a problem throughout the state. We see delays in opening and closing of Dungeness crab fisheries due to domoic acid. And so this problem is moving towards us. And of course, as we're all aware, the loss of marine mammals and birds associated with these events, which is really problematic. Next slide, please. So part of this project, we were tasked with mapping all of the reefs in Santa Monica Bay, which we did. This is, it's hard to get a picture of all the map, you know, all in scale. So not only did we map all of Malibu, all of Palos Verdes, we also, it's difficult to see, mapped a number of the artificial reefs that were built by the Department of Fish and Game, now the Department of Fish and Wildlife, in the 70s and 80s primarily. And so this is a full composite of all the habitats. Just there's about 18,657 hectares of reef habitat. 15% of it, almost 16%, is in the marine protected areas. This is by design. The marine protected area process wanted to protect 15% of the habitat in the statewide program. And so we have very detailed maps of all these nearshore habitats in Santa Monica Bay now. This is all in ArcGIS. It's all uploaded. It's publicly available. Not only can the maps be used and downloaded by anybody, but the biological layers that we generated in this process, which I'll talk a little bit about in a minute, are also overlaid, can be overlaid on those maps and readily available. So that was a big win for us. Next slide, please. However, when we ran, we did some mapping of Malibu during this time frame, this is 2024, in addition to the loss of the kelp habitat, we noticed the dramatic loss of eelgrass resources in Malibu. And so in pink is the 2015 survey, and overlaid on our survey. And so basically, the same process that happened with the kelp is happening with the eelgrass. We noticed a 95% loss of eelgrass in Malibu, and associated with this sedimentation or turbidity from the runoff from these fires, both the Woolsey Fire and the Franklin Fire. And this, as I mentioned, this is 2024, and I was grappling with how to deal with all of this. We finished our surveys for this project that were contracted for this project in November of 2024. And of course, in early 2025, the Palisades fire came through. So our current concern is that what little is left, especially over in Latigo, may be lost due to the runoff from the current the newer fire. Next slide, please. All right, to address these issues and a plethora of others, you don't want to read my report. We were contracted to do 60 sites subtitally in 2023 and 2024. Due to our work with a variety of agencies, we did 81 sites in both 2023 and 2024, and 74 sites were completed in 2025, not funded by this project. Because of the way the database is set up and our goals for the State of the Bay report, because the 2025 data was QAQC'd and included, we're able to include it in all the analyses. This is by far the most extensive and exhaustive study of rocky reefs in the history of the state of California. Next slide, please. So don't look at this slide. This is what I deal with. All right. So we can generate. On the right is years. So going back to 2007, I think. And then we've divided the coast up because there's so many sites. You can't do a plot for every single site. That's just ridiculous. But we broke Malibu up into kind of above the MPA, below the MPA, in the MPA. We have the artificial reefs in the bay proper. And then we have Palos Verdes above the MPA, in the MPA, below the MPA, and the Palos Verdes Restoration Project, basically, as different areas. I just showed this slide of urchins. These are red urchins, a commercial taxa, a very important state commercial species, to give you an idea of the kind of stuff that we are able to now speak to. So first of all, because these are sizes of urchins, so throughout the bay, there are lots of adult harvestable red urchins. In other words, the fishery is, we're not tasked with assessing fisheries, but in terms of having animals that are accessible to the fishery, the bay is doing very well with regard to red urchins. So that's really good. As Carrie mentioned, there's issues with ocean acidification that we know are coming through the system. One problem with ocean acidification is that invertebrates, as when they're young, as their larvae, have real problems with high pH and in the system. They have deformation in their shells, and that will result in reduced recruitment rates into the system. Okay. Looking at all the invertebrates in this study, we haven't seen that yet. But we have the data that shows that they're still recruiting and they're still doing fine, and we have the baseline to be able to assess if this changes in the future. I'm not saying that ocean acidification is not a problem. It is a problem, but it's something we need to be prepared for and start dealing with proactively. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later. Next slide, please. All right. So as another part of this project, we updated the assessment mechanism for looking at these reefs throughout the region. The last time this was done was two State of the Bay reports ago. And our desire was to include a metric that was very tractable basically something that is easily understandable, as opposed to some kind of metric or index or some kind of quasi number, right? And so this is fish production. Essentially, how many fish or how much fish is being produced by a region? It's a model I've been working on for about 15 years. This is essentially cutting edge of assessment for these habitats. It updates the previous assessment model, and so with this kind of information and with the mapping information, you could do things like, you know, ask questions like, how many fish are being produced? That's 20 metric tons a year. How many fish are on the rocky reefs? That's 6.2 million, right? So we can look at this very integratively on large scale, small scale. The take-home message from this, though, when you look at these different regions, is that the marine protected areas are doing well. They could be doing better. The restoration habitats are doing well, in fact, probably as well or better than some of the marine protected areas for a variety of reasons. But unmanaged or basically unaddressed reefs in the system, which are the majority of the reefs, are well below average. And the reason for that is that these marine protected areas and the Palos Verdes Reef are, especially the Palos Verdes Reef as a model, is specifically designed to withstand the sedimentation turbidity and, in essence, the red tide impacts. Right? That's how the reef was designed, and it's performing well. These impacts are still ongoing to these other systems and have really muted the production of our overall system. Right? And this has gotten worse with, as I mentioned, with the red tides, and as well as in Malibu with the runoff from these fires. Right? So you're basically dumping more and more sediment. We're seeing Malibu, what we've seen in Palos Verdes historically, but we're seeing it in real time. Next slide, please. These are, just for kicks and giggles, because I didn't have anything better to do. We pulled all the indicators out of the last State of the Bay report, and so now we're in the position, and this is coded and updatable, of looking at any single indicator that anyone's interested in. This is by region again. There's two arrows for each region, for each indicator. One is the long-term trend, one is the short-term trend. How are things going up, down, or not? And then the color coding is whether or not this assessment index, this assessment is, the section of coastline in this assessment is doing poor, excellent, good, or whatever, relative to the rest of the system. So as you can imagine, this gets super complicated really fast. But overall, we have the ability to really look at any indicator that you're interested in, or someone, you know, that a resource manager perhaps might want to see, and tell you how things are going and where they're going over time. Luke wanted me to remind you that this costs money, and we need more money for monitoring. Thank you, Luke. I appreciate that. But in regard to the State of the Bay report, we've talked about this in the TAC for a little bit and for quite a while, and we wanted to move the State of the Bay report to a position where it is hardwired. In other words, we can collect the 2026 data, which we're planning on doing. Once it's QA'd, QC'd, we can hit a button, every single one of these indices, all the figures you're seeing would be updated immediately, right? So it's all coded. And so that would make this, take the State of the Bay report from this episodic event to a seasonal event, essentially, is what we're trying to do. And so that's our goal. Next slide, please. Okay, so the marine protected areas are performing well. They could be doing better, but they are doing much better than most briefs. And in fact, the good news is the marine protected areas in our bay are doing better than all the rest of the marine protected areas in the state. They were really at the leading edge of performance in terms of how much biomass and fish production is going on. It's really striking. Obviously, there's a severe fire impacts at Malibu. We continue to see sedimentation impacts at Palos Verdes. Artificial reefs are outperforming natural reefs just because they're so high relief and they're getting out of this sedimentation turbidity layer, and they tend to perform better. And then the unmanaged natural reefs are underperforming significantly. We haven't observed ocean acidification indicators yet, which is good. Next slide, please. So our concerns are the continued threat, our long-term concerns, the continued threat from landslides, the new threat from the fire runoff, and really, I think something that this group should deal with or try to figure out is what is going on with these red tides. I deal with stuff like this all the time. It's not one thing. It's a lot of things. But something's gone wrong in the last 5 years that's gone bad. And it's really causing degradation of all of our subtidal ecosystems. The ocean acidification thing, I think, is a threat that's coming through the system. There is things we can do about it ahead of time, as opposed to waiting until it's a problem or more of a problem. We talk about climate change a lot, and what are we going to do about it? Well, we need to realize that it's already happened, right? We're dealing with it now, and so we know the OA problem is coming. There's things you can do. Improved amounts of kelp, the eelgrass, more eelgrass will help buffer the system against acidification. All these restoration and resilience things that we've been working on for years will help the system be ready for what's coming, right? So we need to do more of that. This is a picture of Big Rock post-fire, and one of the things I've been working on is technology that they use in Australia. It was not theoretical. They use reefs to buffer the coastline from swell and wave action to protect the beaches. And in this case, I think the big problem, and it's probably a bigger problem than certainly we can address with reefs, is, you know, what is going to happen to the Pacific Coast Highway now that those homes are gone? And then we've already talked about that. Obviously, and I'll talk about it in my TAC report real briefly, there's a huge opportunity to restore lost ecosystem services in Malibu, and this affects so many people. And that's my last slide, and I'll open it up for questions.
Thank you for the presentation. Are there any comments or questions from the commission? Yes, Tom.
Yeah, Dan, thanks for the presentation and for all the tremendous work that you guys do. It's absolutely, as you pointed out, but I want to just reinforce to everybody, nobody else has done anything like this in the state of California. The ability for us to be able to track these various trends and try to get ahead of the crises as they spin out over time here in the near future, as well as be able to document and define the benefits that these various efforts have resulted in the restoration work that Dan was highlighting. So I hope that all came through. Dan, the question I had was about the fish production. I'm curious how you generate that data and how you sort out take from that. Because I guess where I'm like, hey, maybe there's a lot, that there might be a lot of fish on that reef, but that reef gets fished a lot, so then the fish are being removed. And I'm just curious how you guys factor that in.
Yeah, so the fish production modeling is basically complex system of fishery models, which we generated to essentially produce an estimate of how much biomass is being produced per unit area per year. Right, so it's a rate. And per the question about fishing impacts, if you're fishing a reef hard, which for sure happens, I mean, the fishing pressure at Palos Verdes is much higher than at Malibu for the reason that it's just harder to get to Malibu. You know, I've been above Point Doom and seen no boats for 2-3 days, right? So it's, the impacts there are much lower than Palos Verdes than we're seeing, or any of the artificial reefs in the bay. That being said, if in the model, if you're removing lots of fish, your production goes down because your biomass goes down. So those reefs that are being overfished are producing less fish, essentially is the short end of it. So yeah, that is definitely considered into it. What's interesting is that really high quality habitat that is producing a lot of fish, even if it's being fished, seems to be able to outperform the impacts of fishing. And we've seen that at Palos Verdes. But I'm not just saying that fishing is not an impact. If you look at the system, if you compare what's being fished and the kind of the dampening of the system from the sedimentation and turbidity and the red tide impacts is really in pushing it down in terms of its production. We're looking at a system that's conservatively at about 25% of its capacity. Right. So there's a lot more that could be done with it in terms of how productive it really could be.
Thank you, Dan.
Yes.
Hi, Cody Bridges with Assemblymember Al Marasucci's office. He represents the Palos Verdes Peninsula. Do you happen to know the impact of, or if there is an impact of, the city of Rancho Palos Verdes' use of hydraugers and dewatering wells in relation to the landslide? Do you know if there's any impact on the reef?
I haven't looked at that directly, but I did notice them pumping a lot of water in Abalone Cove.
Yeah.
And that's a marine protected area.
Yeah.
And so as an example, I went and did surveys there while that was happening. And so I was in a marine protected area doing surveys. And I don't want to get into the details of my methods, but essentially you do like 12 transects per depth and saw no fish in a marine protected area. So yeah, so that sedimentation is going in Abalone Cove, and that area has been suffering from the deleterious sedimentation of the plume that still comes out of Portuguese Bend kind of historically, but dumping a bunch of water in it just makes it worse. And yeah, so those sedimentation impacts, that's why I'm saying the marine protected areas are both operating separately, but the Palos Verdes one could be doing better if the water quality was better.
Got it. Appreciate your answer.
Sure.
Are there any other? Oh, yes, Dean.
Thank you. Dean Francois, City Councilman Hermosa Beach. I guess there's just two points maybe you could respond a little bit to regarding the red tide and the health of our ocean and all that. And it seems disturbing that we still have communities, even close to the beaches here, that still don't have street cleaning. And for the life of me, I don't understand it. Obviously, it's known that runoff causes the water quality problems that we have. And I don't know if there's something more that can be done to get make that occur. But I was just wondering if you could comment on that. And also, the other topic is if the county can be more responsive to removing dead sea life and dead seabirds that continue to wash up. It seems to be more and more frequent now than ever, but they'll sit there and contribute to more poor water quality. If there's some way we can get the county to be more responsive in removing dead life on the beach. Thanks.
Thanks, Dean. So I live in Hermosa, as you probably may remember. And people ask me about this all the time. Anything you can do to reduce runoff at any level helps, even a little bit. So in Hermosa, they're putting in the porous concrete. They just put it right in front of my house. I'm so happy. You watch the water run, it goes down, it goes right into the water table. It's fantastic. They did a BMP like that at Crystal Cove in Newport, and I got asked to look at it, and it's just like, but you know, right in the parking lot to stop the runoff into the cove, and the ecology just bounced back immediately, right? So anything you can do on any level to reduce runoff is going to help. So I think it's overwhelming to people, all of these kind of climate change and all the stuff we talk about. It's like they think it doesn't matter, what they do doesn't matter. But even a small amount helps. So I think you're absolutely right. Anything you can do, anything the county can do on any level is going to make a difference. Per the marine mammals and birds, yeah, I don't know. I'm not the one to answer that question about cleaning those up. But yeah, the sooner you get them off the beach, the better, for sure.
Right. They are in an increase, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Because of the red tides.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's all related.
Irrespective of the red tides, there appear to be, you know, as a regular beachgoer, there's more and more of them today than there ever used to be. Dead sea life sitting there washing up, kids playing all around them. I mean, it's unbelievable. Yeah.
You're absolutely right.
Okay, I believe we do have a comment online.
I had one quick question. Yep. Can I go to the comment?
Let's go online real quick, just because I know they've been waiting.
Erica, do you mind?
You want me to wait, or are you asking me to go ahead?
Sorry. No, go ahead.
Okay, thanks. And sorry to whoever else had a question. Dan, thanks so much for your presentation. I feel fortunate that I was able to hear it at the TAC meeting, and now again today. I have three questions. I'll say them. So two from your presentation, like specific slides. So one, you had the slide, I think it was your hand or a hand holding debris from the 2018, maybe from two different fires. And then I was just wondering, I'm really glad you were able to include the 2025 data in your report from additional funding. How long are we gonna be seeing debris coming through, do you think, from the 2025 fires? Do you have a sense of that? That's my first question. Should I pause or just like fire through them?
We could do it one at a time. So as an example, 2 months ago, we were still seeing debris from the Woolsey fire in the Point Dume Marine Protected Area. So 8 years post Woolsey, that stuff is still coming through the system. Right, so my expectation is that we're going to be seeing the impacts of the Palisade fire with the, you know, runoff in terms of whenever it rains for probably 6 to 8 years as well.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Okay, thank you. And then on one of the chart towards the end, the summary table that had, you know, with the arrows and the blues and the salmon, so there were two cells that were white. I don't know, for kelp density and understory macro algae for, I think it was Santa Monica Bay artificial reef and then PV artificial reef. What does that mean where there's no color?
No color, there's no data.
No color, no data. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, got it. Thanks. And then this last one, thank you for bearing with me. I'm not sure. So did I hear you correctly that you're not seeing impacts of ocean acidification? Is that correct?
Yes, we looked at invertebrate recruitment. We have not seen it slow down yet. So okay. That would be a indicator. If we start seeing recruitment failure, that's going to be an indicator at a gross level of the impacts of ocean acidification. There's other impacts that could potentially be out there.
Okay. I was just wondering how that kind of lines with, I know, was it, Tom, you're going to correct me, like, I know the Bay Foundation was able to get monitoring equipment and partnered with, was it LA San? And that was a few years ago, but I don't know if any, who's monitoring specifically now for that, but how, like, are you, like, is there a lag between what you're seeing, like, on the water quality side versus the critters? Thank you.
Yeah, Eric, I got your question. And I'd have to refer to my notes to remember how many of these sensors that we have deployed on the ocean floor in relatively shallow waters. I'd say, you know, they're 80 feet or less. And we're able to measure light. We're able to measure the pH, temperature, and dissolved oxygen, or some combination of those, depending upon the sensors that we're using. So they do give us an idea of, you know, where we're heading with ocean acidification, the shading that Dan speaks to. Some of those sensors are able to pick up some data on that, and we are incorporating those sensor placements with our eelgrass transplant and monitoring existing eelgrass beds and our abalone transplant sites, so that if we see a failed transplant, was it because we did something wrong, or was it 2 weeks where there was, you know, low to near no dissolved oxygen in the water? So that's some of the ways that we're trying to apply those sensors, and we can get some more information out to y'all in some amount of time.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you. And I do want to be sensitive to the time. We're close to the end of this presentation, but we do have additional questions, so if we could.
Well, it's a quickie. Very depressing, especially Palos Verdes. And as far as the slide goes down there, I mean, they've been pumping that water out of there since it started. And when they first said it was high in mineral contents, toxic to sea life, that's the water. Now, the sediment and that's underneath that we're talking about is killing it off as well. You come around the corner to that reef that you all work there, off the Donald's golf course. What's it look like there? Now, is that clouded with that sediment, or is that water quality affecting it? And I mean, it's still sliding. It's still pumping water out. So are they both working in tag team and killing everything off down there? And what's more toxic, the highly mineral content in the water, or the runoff, or both? Tell me, Dan. Tell me. Solve these problems.
Wow, that's a loaded question. Yeah. I don't know. So I'm unaware of the relationship between the mineral content in the water and whether or not that's killing off sea life or hurting it. Not to say that it doesn't happen. The challenge with both Abalone Cove and the Palos Verdes Reef is that sedimentation or turbidity impacts were ongoing before this started happening. Yeah. So you basically have this historic sedimentation problem from what happened at the Portuguese Bend landslide. That plume, if you, like I showed in my very first slide, has been going on and on and on. And so we were seeing that impact in the marine protected area before they started pumping, right? And so to try to, you know, from an ecological standpoint, disarticulate those two processes is not really going to be doable with our data. Yeah. You know, it's. But I just know it's not good.
It's always been an active landslide, but it's certainly much more active lately than.
Well, it's been an active landslide, but it stopped dumping sediment into the marine environment quite a while ago. Right, and even when it started moving again, we had this weird pendulum action where the subtidal reef became intertidal, and actually there's more intertidal zone now there because of it, but it's not releasing sediment at the toe of the slide, which is fortunate, because if that happens, then everything's lost anyway. Yeah, so. Sure.
And then for our final question and comment before our director speaks, but go ahead, Carrie.
Great, Dan. I have a lot of questions, but I can save some of them for another time. But is there going to be environmental data integrated with the Rocky Reef chapter, or is that like sort of relegated to a separate chapter? Is one question.
So you're talking about
like oceanographic data or like temperature data or anything to, that might.
We haven't put it in yet. Over the last 5 years the time frame of this chapter, we didn't see any real major changes in any of those parameters. People ask me about temperature a lot, and you know, we had a big El Nino 2015-2016 blob temperature effect that went through the system, caused real problems with the echinoderms, and then the water just got icy cold after that. So the general idea that our coastline is heating up, which it is from the long-term trend, on shorter term, it's definitely much more dynamic than that, and spatially, it's much more variable than that. Certain parts of our coastline will stay cold even when it's hot due to local upwelling, and so we didn't put that information into it. It actually got colder during this period than.
Yeah, but I think it just might be good to put that in there, especially if you're trying to turn it into this more like plug and chug report of just updating it.
Yeah, I think that's an appropriate thing for the State of the Bay report.
Yeah, okay.
Right.
And then just maybe one other thing is that about the, maybe just because this is a public meeting, I maybe wanted to clarify that I think part of the reason that we do see really strong MPA responses in Southern California is because fishing mortality rates are higher in Southern California than some of the other marine protected areas across the state. So it doesn't necessarily mean that the MPAs in other regions are underperforming. It's just that there wasn't, if the only management action is removing fishing and there wasn't much fishing before, then you wouldn't expect to see a big change in fish biomass. And there are ways that your data set would be awesome to use to estimate fishing mortality rates at some of those sites using this population modeling framework that I've been involved with before, and I'd be happy to chat about later.
Thanks, Gary.
And then Luke, did you have a final comment?
Yeah, I just wanted to tie this report back to our wetlands chapter, because those are the two State of the Bay chapters we have now. The findings from that one were the restored wetlands were performing better than the unstored, ones where there wasn't any intervention or restoration happening. So it seems like management actions are helping. We know what to do. We have a lot of problems to solve, and the issues are large, but at least we know what to do, it seems, or know part of what to do.
Okay, then thank you very much for the excellent presentation, all the questions and comments. This brings us to item 4C. It's a presentation on the Coastal Access and Beach Visitor User Data Study. Luke, if you could introduce that item.
Thank you. So in November 2021, Congress passed the IIJA, which was previously referred to as the BIL, Bureau or Bipartisan Infrastructure Law. To invest in the nation's infrastructure and resilience, the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act (IIJA) it allocated $132 million to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to be distributed evenly among the 28 national estuary programs for activities that further the CCMP. So for the Santa Monica Bay National Estuary Program, that amounted to approximately $900,000 annually over 5 years. And that funded seven projects under the initiative. And those seven projects are nearing completion. So this is just the first of the projects to provide a presentation to the governing board. So today we are joined by Mark Baylor, the executive director of Beacon. That stands for the Beach Erosion Authority for Clean Oceans and Nourishment. He will be presenting on the Coastal Access and Beach Visitor User Data Study. So, Mark, I will share your slides here. Just give me one moment.
Thanks, Luke. And while he does that, I would like to introduce myself, because for me, this is a little bit of a homecoming. I've sat as a member of the Santa Monica Bay Restoration Commission representing the Coastal Conservancy. I've staffed actions of the Restoration Commission as the project manager for the initial Prop 12 Santa Monica Bay allocation. And in the time I was doing that, we committed about $12 million of the $25 million. So I'm glad to be back here and excited to present today on our topic. So when my slides come up, I'll start. There we go. So I'm very happy to have this opportunity to present the collaborative research that the Bay Foundation, the Commission, and Beacon are undertaking. And today we'll be presenting some just high-level information as we finish our technical report and our information data portal work. But I also want to acknowledge that this project is a result of many organizations and many people besides the Bay Foundation and Beacon. And I want to identify the technical research and program staff of the Mountains Recreation and Conservation Authority, MRCA, which one of the members is the Santa Monica Bay Santa Monica Mountains Conservancy, the staff of California State University Channel Islands, University of California, California Sea Grant, the University of Washington, and formerly US EPA. Can you, next slide, please. So I first want to just remind you of who Beacon is. Beacon is your most adjacent neighbor on the west. We are the counties of Ventura and Santa Barbara and the six coastal cities from Goleta to Point Hueneme. And we collaborate with the Bay Foundation and Santa Monica Bay Restoration Commission because we share multiple landscapes. We share physical landscapes, the littoral cells that are connected between the Santa Barbara littoral cell and yours. Ecological landscapes. We share many of the same nearshore and nearshore ocean environments with you, and we certainly share the impacts, both negative and positive, of coastal draining watersheds. And I've provided this exhibit to show you the extent of the connection between the land and the water. In our region, 97% of all our sediments and sand come from our creeks and streams. And you can see that several of them are really large river systems that produce an enormous amount of sand and sediment. But in the absence of natural systems that have been interrupted, debris dams, dams, roads, rail, urban development, those natural connections have broken down. But the point here is that Beacon is active in collaborating with our regional partners like the Bay Foundation, SQIRP that you already mentioned, and a lot of the other technical resources. But I want to remind you just quickly who Beacon is, why we're here, and why we would want to continue the partnership that we've established over many years with you all. Next slide, please. Our and today I'm focusing on coastal access data. Why are we preserving the coast? Well, one of the reasons is because people use the coast, as we well know. But we don't know that much about how many people use the coast or what they do at the coast, even though we all observe and participate ourselves in beach activities. But our work on access data goes back 20, 25 years. But in the last 5 years, frustrated by the lack of contemporary beach access data available to the public and decision makers, and frustrated by the expense it takes to collect this kind of data, which we've invested in repeatedly over time, we sought out new sources of data. So today I'm going to talk to you about how we integrate traditional sources of data with novel sources of data. And we focused on a variety of novel sources. One is real-time recording and observation, and that's done through cameras and video installations. Protective of people's personal privacy, directed really at the larger landscape questions. We're investigating different ways to cost-effectively collect data. And then we're trying to integrate all these sources. So one of the ways in which we've done this is to acquire mobile phone or cell phone data, locationally directed data, from vendors and from university partners to begin to understand how this large-scale data could be used and integrated with more traditional sources. And today I'm going to actually report on two efforts that we've done most recently to give you a flavor for the kinds of data that in a way track the physical and ecological data. There are data gaps. There are data costs. The monitoring that we've been doing for human use mirrors the constraints of the monitoring we do in Beacon for physical and ecological conditions. And that's one of the topics that Beacon continually focuses on. And as you know, because you've heard it already, there's very little money in the state general bond obligation, in general obligation bonds, that's allowed to be used for planning that's not related to a specific shovel-ready project. So we have funding constraints in supporting these monitoring efforts that we haven't really solved yet. Next slide, please. One of the things I want to mention is that we're swimming in a bigger river. Although we have work that we are doing on this topic, some work precedes us because we found others working, including Dr. Nathaniel Merrill in Nantucket, working for US EPA, who had been also trying to figure out how to use a new technology and new sources of data to estimate beach use. So, unfortunately, though, Dr. Merrill was employed at EPA and was a collaborator with us. Now Dr. Merrill is employed at Beacon and other agencies because now he's a private contractor. That's an unfortunate loss for us, but we continue to keep those connections. And we gain something out of that because the work that Dr. Merrill did has informed our work here in California. And because of our connections across the state, this work is starting to be done in other regions within the state, San Francisco Bay and the North Coast. Next slide, please. So I wanted to just emphasize quickly, and if you know this already, I don't mean to replow old ground, but because we're a diverse group of people, I thought a little bit of background would be helpful. In the past, we've done survey work and beach count work. And you can imagine that's very timely. It's staff intensive. And the return you get is very valuable, but it's limited. And then there are other ways in which we've done telephone surveys, random digit dialing, surveys of the state population otherwise, and they have been important. And you had one here in the region that informed some of the work in 2017, 2018 out of the UCLA Institute of the Environment. And Drs. Christensen and King, and Phil's been he's on our science committee, but he's been a consultant to us as well, did quite a bit of work at that time trying to identify beach users and issues around beach use. In the last, as I say, in the last 3 to 5 years, you see that we've now looked at other non-traditional methods, so-called novel methods. Cell phone mass data has been one of the objects, and we're not the only ones that are looking at this. Others are as well. And then recording, camera recording, video recording, other ways in which we can assemble profiles of physical conditions along the coast and coastal use. And then we've been experimenting with social media. There's a lot of ways in which already we collect information from users through social media, but we think there are other ways we can do that because the survey results we get are they're invaluable, they're important, but they come in smaller numbers. And so if we can somehow make this more efficient and an ongoing process of information collection, we'd be better able to manage our beaches and understand the pressures on our beaches. Next slide, please. So why is it important for us to plan together? This is just but one exhibit from our early work, and I don't think you should focus on the numbers so much as the relationships. So we have studied beaches in Santa Barbara, Ventura, and Los Angeles County. The Beacon beaches are the Ventura, Santa Barbara counties. But what we got as a result of our work is we identified beach user areas. We call them market areas, but you can call them whatever you want. Every beach seemed to have a signal. People prefer certain beaches over others. They don't substitute one for another very easily. But you can see in this graphic that Ventura and Santa Barbara beaches welcomed more than 10 million LA County residents to their beaches. And the reverse exists as well. And so we share market. We share resources together. And I'll just make one point that we started this analysis somewhat after COVID, because the COVID summers were really the summer of 2020 and 2021. By 2022, people had, notwithstanding the COVID emergency proclamations, people had returned to prior activities because schools had reopened and parks had reopened. But in that period, we found enormous cross-use. If LA County closed the beach or the parking lot at Zuma to the beach, Deer Creek and Wainimi took all those users. People didn't stop going to the beach. They just were displaced from one location to another. When Wainimi and Ventura had parking lot controls, the western Los Angeles County beaches had higher use. And so we share these resources together. So that's why we think it's important to plan together. But this is just one example of how this works. And as we continue our work, we'll be identifying even more significant crossover activities spatially and temporally and across our beaches. Next slide, please. So what are we doing in our project? Well, we're going to produce a technical report. It's in review now. The numbers are being reviewed by the technical interior and exterior consultants that we've got. And then we're developing a, for lack of a better word, a dashboard or a portal or some way we can, as Dan was talking about his project, get this up in, so that people can use this in real time and that we can add to it and modify it and bring it up to a long-term data repository and portal. Next slide, please. So today I want to report on a couple things. One is the use of these traditional so-called intercept surveys. So we took 9 beaches, 5 of them in Los Angeles County, a few in Ventura and Santa Barbara, and we did counts on the beach. We did entrance counts as people came to the beach, and then we did surveys. And we collected almost 700 surveys across 5 days on these 9 beaches. So I just want to report some of the information because, again, we swim in a bigger river. So our survey mirrored and built on surveys that were done earlier. The UCLA survey, Cal State Channel Islands did a survey in 2022, and we took the benefit of their work, and we had done a survey earlier in the mid-aughts, and we updated those survey questions, made them consistent, but also tried to grow them and what our concerns are about. And so this just shows you the locations that we picked. It's a selection of large beaches, small beaches, Malibu beaches, Santa Monica Bay beaches, and then some Beacon beaches. Next slide, please. So one thing I want to talk about in terms of combined information is that what you're seeing is a map of the zip code locations of the almost 700 survey respondents that we completed. It represents almost 250 zip codes in the region, and we just have the LA County map here because we want to show you the geographic and the spatial extent of beach use. And so we use the zip code as a way to kind of validate some of the cell phone data that's based on census tracts and census block groups as to origin location. So we try to combine these in a way that see how they validate and calibrate with one another, and they do. And in general measure, they do quite well. But this is just an example of how you might use the data that we do derive from these surveys and put it on a GIS platform and then be able to use it to reflect on who are the beach users. And then this is for all the 9 beaches. We can divide it by individual beach. We can do a lot with the data, as Dan was saying about the Rocky Reef data, in order to do further analysis. Next slide, please. So what do we ask people and what do we care? And why do we have different sources of data? Well, novel sources of data like cell phone can give you origin and location of and destination. They can't tell you the size of your party, how long you're staying, or the other factors about preferences, practices as a beach user. So this, if I'm not mistaken, is, I can get that right. Describing people in your party and information around how long you might stay at the beach. These are important management questions, of course. So next slide, please. And I'll go through these because I know the time is. So this is length of stay, and you can see that although we haven't compared to the previous study from 22, we did talk to the authors of that study, and it tracks pretty well as to how long people have as a beach visit. Now, this reflects people on the sand, toes in the sand, between 1 and 5 p.m. across, as I said, 5 to 8 different days. It's very expensive to enumerate people on a beach and to get a full day enumeration, because the issue here, of course, is the user profile changes through the day. Water sports in the morning are more important, as you know, because of the wave and swell conditions. We have a need to more specifically profile all the beach users around the entirety of the beach experience. But we're starting out with how we traditionally count people actually on the sand, but we're starting to enumerate in the water as well. Next slide, please. This is very interesting, and I want to just stop here for 1 second. We asked people to tell us why they chose the beaches they chose. And you can see there are myriad factors for why people choose a particular location. But they come to the beach to do a variety of things, very big diversity of things. They don't come for one thing, and that's important as to we understand the management of the beach and the beach experience across time. So I'll just say that we asked almost 25 answers, and these are the top 17, I think. It makes for a very complicated relationship with the beach user community. But it also informs how the managers and the decision makers understand the beach experience in our region. Next slide, please. The other side about picking a beach is, what do you choose to do at the beach? What did you come for? And again, we get a lot of diverse activities of people coming to the beach, but one thing that we did unearth is the common sense notion that a lot of people come for the sand, but a lot of people come from the water. And then within the water activity, there's an active water sports community. So a lot of people come to the beach to do passive water activities with their children, with themselves, and then some subset of that are the active windsurfers, board surfers, boogie boarders, and all the other things that represent the water experience as part of the beach experience, which we think is important because it affects the profile of when people come and how people use the beach and how long they stay and what they do. Next slide, please. And I'm summarizing these because these are the kinds of information that we've been collecting for a very long time. And these concerns and these topics don't change so much across time very quickly, but they do change. So what I want to focus on here is we ask people to tell us the experience from their point of view of the beach as they visit it. And so what are important factors with regard to choosing a beach and coming to a beach? And you can read them down, but if you go to the next slide, I want to emphasize that if you look across all the beaches, and these are the survey responses from all the beaches, what you find is that there's a lot of commonality about what are concerns. So we identified the top concerns, and they kind of nest around safety, cleanliness, safety, and adequate facilities, both on the sand and in the water. People note when they don't have adequate facilities at a beach location. They also note if they don't have those facilities, where they can choose to go to the beach. And a lot of our beaches have, I'll just say they're minimal facilities as opposed to fully developed facilities. A lot of our beaches are fully developed with parking and restrooms and vending and all these other things, but not all of them are. So I wanted to say that I think there's a lot of agreement among the beach-using community as to what constitutes the kind of beach experience that they want as people and as users. So the next slide, please. This is a barriers to the beach question. So we think it's important to identify, as you've discussed before, that different communities face different barriers. And our underserved communities, our so-called disadvantaged communities, have historically had significantly more barriers to get to the beach. The most common thing is spatially, they're geographically, they're not as close to the beach. But what you find is that however the community is from, issues of cost and access to the coast, they're very common issues. The cost of a beach day, the availability of adequate and accessible parking. So we've identified for the beach using community their concerns around barriers, because we want to talk about how to overcome these barriers. But again, we're just identifying the concerns from the community. How we actually address these will be done in future survey work and additional methods of focus groups and other ways to really get into these topics in greater detail. Next slide, please. So we ask actually quite a few questions about economics and family structure and everything, and we'll be reporting all those in our report. But I wanted to, we ask a couple questions that have not been asked before in the surveys that we've observed. So we ask the beach-going community, what do you know about sea level rise and climate issues? And surprisingly, as you can see from the results, people feel they know quite a bit about this issue. And then we ask them, so do you act on that information? So next slide, please. So we ask them, do they ever volunteer beach cleanups or any other kind of community improvement? And I would focus not on the three-quarter red in the circle. I'd focus on the 25% of the green. A few hundred people responded that they already volunteer, that they're already active, that they are acting on the knowledge. I think this is a reflection of the work of the Bay Foundation and the commission and your partners in recruiting from the larger community the stakeholder stewards that you need, that we need, in order to maintain these resources. So we were, and I hope you're all surprised by this, we were surprised that this large a percentage are already socialized to be active stewards of the resources they choose to recreate and consume from. And we're going to pursue this kind of questioning more to get at this as to how we can engage communities as we survey them, as we ask them for things. How can we engage them about getting them more connected to the stewardship activities as well as the other activities? So next slide, please. So one of the things that you can do with this traditional data, and we'll talk about it with regard to other data, is you can ask people what their race and ethnicity is and how much money they make and their family size. And so for the survey results, we did collect money information on demographics. And so we report that back out. And I think it's important to talk about the issue of a representation and then beach use. And what we find is that although many of our beaches are very diverse and beach use is diverse, underrepresented populations in our region don't visit the beach as much as their population size would necessarily proportionally indicate. So that's a need. Other communities seem to enjoy beach use more pronounced way. So, but it's important that you can collect demographic information to understand who we are as a community and who we are as beachgoers. So that's a little flavor of the use of traditional data. And we did collect all this survey information, and we're matching it with the novel information that we're collecting. But let me just spend a few minutes on the novels, cell phone data. So next slide, please. Thank you. So across the three counties, we actually took all the Coastal Commission coastal access beaches through their guide, and we geolocated every beach, geofenced it, and then we have separate beach locations now, about 150 of them, I think, across the three counties that represent the big beach, public beach resources of the counties. So we tried to enumerate the beach access locations and then tried to collect the data from the cell phone community in order to understand the diversity of beach use across the region. So next slide, please. So what do we actually do this? And I just want to talk about this a little bit, because we're not counting people. We're counting cell phone pings within a geofenced location as a placeholder for a person. And then we're translating from pings into people. And because it's not an entire universe, it's an algorithm and it's an estimate. And this information comes from private vendors, and it's a subset of all the cell phones that exist. And then individual vendors have their own, and then, as you know, you can opt out now or opt in, and so it's a subset of all that. And then do people have cell phones on their person, and do they represent one person or a carload of people? So we fence off an area. So this just happens to be the Santa Monica State Beach. And then it includes major destination facilities that we think need to be enumerated separately. So we identify Oceanfront Walk as a separate geofenced area, separate from the beach sand. We geolocated and fenced off the pier. And then we did the Marvin Browdy coastal bike path. And though we've methodologically debated how much overlap there is between those different users, I would say that if you all go out to this beach and you sat there and you looked, what you'd find is there's less overlap than you think. That the bike community is, yes, many of them bring their bike, stop their bike, and go to the sand. I got that. But a lot of them don't. And people walk on the bike path, which is interesting, outside of the Oceanfront Walk, but they're all dressed in long pants, and they're all on a walking thing. And so we thought that better that we separately enumerate. And as to pier users, you know the pier is elevated above the sand at Santa Monica Beach. There isn't really a good connection between the sand and the pier. But pier users, because it's a recreational commercial pier, are generally pier users. So we're working with the data scientists to figure out how we can talk about this. But we've now separately enumerated all the bike paths on the beach, all the pier, public piers, and the importance here, although it's a little bit weeds in the weeds. So if you fish on a public pier in California, what don't you need to fish? You don't need a fishing license. Why is that important? Because fishing license and the cost of fishing license and the cost of parking is a burden on lower income visitors. And so having fishing available on a pier free has created its own market. And not here in your region, but next door at Point Hueneme, they actually offer 24-hour access to their fishing pier, because a lot of the fishing is done very early in the morning and can be done later. And so they have a separate kind of sense of who that market is. And so we've adopted that as understanding who our beach users that go to these other facilities might be, and what would that mean for beach use. So anyways, this is an example of how you develop a, they call it a POI, kind of project of interest, or an area. We call it just a beach location, and this is an example of how we do it. Next slide, please. I think the next slide is it's a closer-in view of, you can see the geofencing around the individual facilities. Next slide, please. So And I don't know if you can see these quite well. We're working on the color and how they display. What we found was, as I was explaining, that beaches have their own user group, and that they're different between beaches geographically and spatially. And we need to talk about this. So big regional draws like Santa Monica are easy to understand why it would be a regional draw, a statewide draw, an international draw. But across the many beaches that we've surveyed, these so-called boomas are different. And so we've started to disaggregate and identify them. And what you're seeing in the shaded colors of blue is the strength of the use of that beach from that location. So, I mean, it makes a lot of sense. Around the coast, there's a lot of beach use. People are riding to the beach, bringing their cars and everything. And as you move to the region, the shades go lighter because there's less users, obviously. But the important point here is that spatially and geographically across the region, people come to the beach from all over already, notwithstanding the barriers that they face. And this was surprising to some of the data scientists and some of the observers as to the extent of beach use in the region. Now, what we also provide on this, and we'll talk about this a little, on this exhibit right here, is you see the red lines are actually county supervisorial districts. It's important to understand the geographic governance of the region, because as you know, in our region, the county operates a lot of our beaches, but they also fund a lot of our beaches, and they have four or five supervisors that exist from a mile away from the beach to almost 100 miles away from the beach. So this is an example of the kinds of tool we're developing so people could look around at the various destination beaches and then understand where are people coming to those beaches. And then we have summary to show the entire region. But it's an example of the kinds of data we're developing and data visualization. So it can be useful to the stakeholder community and to the decision makers. Next slide, please. And catch me on time if I'm going too long on this, and I'll just I'll speed up my presentation. This is important in the terms of context of the Bay and Beacon joining together. You host a lot of Ventura County residents, Beacon constituents. And Malibu, when you look at this map, is instructive because it's the front porch of Ventura, not just the front porch of Los Angeles. And you see Simi and Thousand Oaks and Westlake Village, but you also see the valley. And so this part of our beach resources really does derive users from both the local community and then what I think of as the local community, the Ventura community as well. And so we need to know this. We share resources. We probably need to share management. And for the Santa Monica Mountains Conservancy, that's part of MRCA, they cover the entire mountains. So they have a Ventura and a Los Angeles County constituency, and we're talking all the time to about that relationship. Next slide, please. So as I said, interestingly enough, beaches have their own distinct user community. So Dockweiler is a very important beach in Santa Monica Bay. Dockweiler is at the end of the Imperial Highway, directly east of Watts, Willowbrook, Hawthorne, Inglewood, maybe not Hawthorne, Inglewood. These are communities that are relatively adjacent to a beach community, but are considered in the kind of conventional wisdom to be far away from the beach because of the reasons we talked about earlier, barriers. But Dockweiler is one of our most heavily used beaches for a big part of Los Angeles. But you can see the regional draw at the same time. A lot of people are attracted to different beaches for different reasons. And we know, because of anecdotally, that Dockweiler is important to many communities. But one of them is the enjoy the beach at the night bonfire community. This is one of the last places in California that you can actually go to a fire pit and enjoy the beach at night. But it has other stuff. We focused on day use, I should say that. For our county, we focused on day use. So we kind of excluded the overnight RV camping community there in favor of the day users. So, because day use for us is an important first step for this. But we know that there is overnight accommodations there as well. So it's a very diverse beach. It's a very interesting beach by facilities. Dockweiler has a youth center. I don't know if you all know this. It has a youth center that's actually heavily used. And so if it has all those facilities, the question that we always think about, and Beacon has similar beaches in our region, is are we actively marketing those to the community that would be interested to use them? And is it available to them in any effective way, cost-effectively or otherwise? So Dockweiler is a beach that we've identified because if we're going to address issues of underrepresentation, we need to talk about the physical and spatial structure of that. And as I said, we'll get into this with regard to a little discussion around Biona. We're starting to look at the bike trails that are off-road to the beach. And so we did Biona, which is almost now a 9-mile bike path, almost up to mid-city. And we geofenced that, and then we cut it into sections so we could see people riding on that, beach users and not. And you'd be surprised to find that about 3 million people a year use that bike path. And a good many of them get to Playa del Rey and get to the beach and use Dockweiler State Beach as part of that experience. But not in the way that we would say across time they probably could or should over time as we seek more ways in which to make access to the beach more available. Next slide, please. So again, in the cell phone link, in the big data, we can get the same information about demographics that we can get in the traditional data. And here, this just reflects the distribution of beach users by race and ethnicity. And we identify the big categories of a population, and then we just match them. And you can see that across the three counties, it's slightly different. And then there's a summary as to the three counties together. We think the three counties are three individual communities, however, that need their own assessment. But we also think it's valuable to compare and contrast at the same time. So next slide, please.
So Mark, do you think you could wrap up in 2 minutes?
Yes, I can,
okay,
actually.
Thanks.
Perfect timing. Thank you for reminding me. So the previous slide was a slide of all the beaches together. This is a slide of selected beaches in your county as to demography. And you can see that among the beaches, there's a great diversity of representation. If you look at, I think it's Royal Palms and then White Point, those are two Palos Verde San Pedro locations. So why are they more diverse than others? Well, it's Wilmington, San Pedro. I think that's the answer. They're close by, they're accessible, and they're low cost. If you look at Dockweiler towards the top, you'll see that, I believe, because of its culture, location, history, because of the bad history here in beach use, that is the historic legacy history as well as the good history, you'll see it's a very diverse beach as well. So our beaches allow for great diversity. They're locally representative, but they're also regionally representative. But the important point here is we can derive this kinds of information from the mass data as well as the traditional data. And we think it's important if we're going to do planning for the beach to address all our communities and make access for all the standard by which we judge the success or not. Okay, next slide. So one way that we just wanted to illustrate how we can show you who goes to what beach is just I picked out Dockweiler because we did an assessment of it, and you can see the demographic diversity at that beach. And I think this is important information. Now, this represents a portion of the two parking lots on the north side of the entrance. It's not the entire beach. We were experimenting to see how we would get it. The total beach would be a little different than this, but the important categories are that there, and it's a discussion the community can have and should have. We're having it in our region as well because we have a series of local beaches that serve local regional visitors, and we're struggling to figure out the best way to encourage those who don't go to the beach to break down barriers and greater accessibility. So next slide. So this is just an example of how we would use the data. So I'll be quick. Again, this is Dockweiler, and the shaded gray areas are the census tracts that represent, by the state's designation, disadvantaged communities. And you can say many are represented by beach use of Dockweiler, and many are not represented by beach use of Dockweiler. So the question is, how is it that some people can manifest a beach visit in spite of these constraints and others don't? And this is some of the work we'll be doing going forward. So next slide. So we can combine all these into what we think will be a useful tool to help decision makers. So now you have the BUMA for Dockweiler, then you have the census tracts that are the disadvantaged census tracts, and next slide, please. And you can lay over the governance structure. So this has the supervisor's district, the disadvantaged census tracts, and the users of Dockweiler. And you can see the gap and the void, the opportunity and the constraints, all in a map product. Now, I just said that. It won't be the full story. It won't be a number. It'll be an estimate and a projection. So what I'm showing you in these exhibits is the distribution of beach users across space. I haven't given you one number. I haven't told you how many people go to Dockweiler. I haven't told you how many people we think go to Santa Monica. We're working those numbers now, because the general take-home is the geographic distribution and then the distribution across these different communities and how we all use the beach. So if next slide, please. This is the tool we're developing. You can see that it's a GIS-based dashboard-type tool. We have many different layers that we've curated already, and we think the layers that involve demographics, income, race, all these topics are important. And then this would allow the user, the decision makers, however we set this up, to go and investigate this data and do whatever data analysis they might want to do. The managers of these sites, the users of the sites, the decision makers who fund the money and improve the sites. So I'll stop there. Thank you very much for the opportunity to present these high-level results, as it were. We'll be producing a report that'll be available to the Bay Foundation, and we'll be producing this beta dashboard in conversation with the Bay Foundation and the data scientists to figure out what the best way is to display this information. We continue to collect this information, and we're excited to continue to partner with you all because we think we've opened a box that needs more examination, more planning, more monitoring money, and more collaboration among us all. Thanks again for the opportunity to speak today. I would say that happy to answer any questions, and then as a secret surprise guest, one of our data scientists, Dr. Merrill, is on the phone and can help me answer any questions you may have. And I appreciate Nate's participation in our project. He's led us to a great sense of how to use this data and how it might assist us in our management of the beach. Thanks.
Thank you for the presentation, and I appreciate your willingness to answer questions. We are running a little bit long on our agenda. Are there any very brief questions or comments from the commission? Yes.
I have a brief question.
Of course.
Okay, well, thank you, Mark. That was very interesting. Thank you for also focusing on Dockweiler. Appreciate that. I had a question about your survey questionnaire about how people were acting on their knowledge about climate change and sea level rise. You reported on their volunteering, but people do other things than volunteer in the face of information. And so I was wondering if you asked them any questions about how they voted, how they feel about taxes, how they feel about stormwater regulations, a lot of things that we as the commission are in charge of. Thanks.
In short, the answer is no, we didn't dive deeply into that, but I believe that's the subject for how we're gonna do subsequent work. And so I welcome the collaboration and the suggestion for what we should add into our survey work, because we'll be continuing this. So thanks for that.
Thank you, and we have a quick comment.
Yeah, so just a quick comment. This is Jasmine Reinhart from the Santa Monica Mountains RCD. I just wanted to say this is a really, this type of information is really helpful, especially as we think about the work that we were talking about, right? It's like we can have something like this on paper, but what data do we have to actually support, you know, grants or projects that we do? I just wanted to say, having previously worked for the National Park Service at the Golden Gate National Recreation Area, managed lots of beaches, three counties. This type of data was instrumental in planning work that we would do in partners and soliciting grants and funding. So very interested in this, and thank you.
And then we have a brief comment or question online.
Hi, Mark. Erica Yelensky with EPA. Thanks so much for your presentation. I've been looking forward to this for some time. Just quickly, the 25 questions that you asked, the survey questions, so it was the same at all of the beaches. I'm just curious, I'm not asking you to share the data now, but I'm curious if those answers differed significantly by beach, or if there's anything you could say to that. Is that make sense?
Yes, it does. Thanks, Erica.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, so in our report, we break it up by beach, but on some of the beaches, it's a smaller number, so we caution everyone about that. So yeah, we'll report out by beach, and then we summarize for all beaches together, and you'll be able to look at the range of answers. But I would say this, that within the questions, the range is fairly small. Certain issues come up for certain beaches, necessarily. We didn't cover that in our summary remarks. But yeah, we'll go into the individual beach response. And then the question is, how do those 9 beaches represent the 147 other beaches? And that's what we're discussing now, and we'll comment on that, and then you'll have that as a boundary or a constraint on how much you'll take away from the individual responses. So I want to caution everybody that it's a lot of answers, but when you divide it by 9 beaches, it becomes a smaller community of respondents. So we want to repeat this, and we want to elaborate with additional questions, because we took a lot of time of having trained enumerators. We have a training module and all these things now teed up. Sorry for the long answer.
Thank you so much. And I am hoping that there's more opportunity for folks at the table to interact with you and the data, because I'm sure that this has brought up a lot of questions, and I know we're short on time. Thanks.
Thank you again for the opportunity.
Thank you. So if there are no other questions or comments, that brings us back to item 2 on the agenda, informational items. And we are at item 2B, which is the report from the chair. I do have a brief update from our chair. On May 21st, the executive committee did meet at the Edward C. Little Water Recycling Facility in the city of El Segundo. At that time, we established the June Governing Board meeting agenda. We also approved the adaptation strategy of the Santa Monica Bay National Estuary Program work plan. The executive committee member stated that discrepancies between the adaptation strategy and the commission's vulnerability assessment and comprehensive monitoring program will need to be addressed. The discrepancies arose from the passing of the action plan in February of 2026. Lastly, we did discuss a potential path forward for developing the actions under Goal 6 of the action plan. The staff will begin researching plans and policies that can help inform Goal 6. And if you do have any questions on that, I encourage you to ask Martha when she returns. And so that brings us to item 2C, report from the Technical Advisory Committee.
I'll hand it over to Dan Pondell, our TAC chair.
Thanks, Luke. We met on May 19th. I give my more extensive presentation of what you saw today. The TAC was pleased with that. We also had a discussion about integrating with SQRP from Dr. Eric Stein on some of these Bay-wide issues and Southern California Bight issues. Other than that, I just have an announcement associated with the follow-up from the work we've been doing, and that the Ocean Protection Council's 3030 project is funding stakeholder and the Malibu Restoration Plan for our coastline, and that'll be overseen by my lab. So we just got a $360,000 grant to keep working on this Malibu issue, which is obviously pretty salient.
That's great to hear. That brings us to item 2D, a report from the Santa Monica Bay Restoration Commission Administrative Director and SMBNEP Director. So I'll hand it off to Luke Ginger and Tom Ford.
Thank you. I'll keep my statements brief. Commission staff have been working on the State of the Bay chapters, obviously the latest one being the Rocky Reef chapter. These chapters are being developed by our Prop 50 grantees, and the next ones won't be due until the end of 2027. So we kind of have a gap. We had these first two, wetlands, Rocky Reefs. Now we have a gap, and the other ones will follow. So I'll continue to work with the TAC on developing those. Commission staff presented to the Commission of the Southern California Coastal Water Research Project, or SQRP. I presented to them a couple weeks ago on ways to increase collaboration between the SMBRC and the Bight Regional Monitoring Program. So SQRP coordinates this regional monitoring program that happens every 5 years. Do I have that right? 5 years? So they're sitting on a huge treasure trove of data. Well, they're not sitting on it, but it's a huge treasure trove of data that could be used by this commission. So I was happy to present there. And then finally, the environmental scientist vacancy for the commission, the other staff member on the commission, has been filled. So that person has not started yet. I will introduce them at the next meeting. That concludes my update. I can hand it over to Tom now.
Thank you, Luke. Could you pull up that presentation?
Yes, sorry.
Not at all. maybe while that's coming up, one of the things I think sort of fell through our conversation today at this meeting, conversations about runoff, you know, toxins or pollutants or constituents, hyposalinity, I mean, freshwater inputs. The nutrients are certainly a very big part of this, and I've been very pleased with the amount of conversation that I've been part of in this region by largely involving the sanitation districts of the county and the city, looking at that recycled water program or the various recycled water programs, many of which are identified in our CCMP, to firstly generate a reliable source of drinking water, a safe, clean one, and the opportunity therein to dramatically reduce nutrient loading to the bay, which is a tremendous contributor to local coastal ocean acidification and those harmful algal blooms. So if you're sitting there trying to find some way to take action on that or encourage people, these are the types of investments which are in the billions in this region. We lead the nation in that regard without a doubt. And one of the functions of this National Estuary Program is I'm able to be your emissary in D.C. and continue to bring attention to this matter within the EPA administration and with our other partners around the country. So thank you all for all of your hard work on all those matters. And as for hard work from other folks who are not at the table, that's what I hope to feature in my attempt to address Martha's guidance that she'd like to see some more pictures and some more videos. So I've got a few for you coming up. Abalone. I hope that 6,000 number is accurate. I think that that is the number of abalone that we at the Bay Foundation have been working with this year alone in LA County. There are additional abalone that have gone elsewhere, and we're a little over 10,000 in that regard, going into the waters from Santa Barbara all the way down through San Diego. These animals are bred from captive broodstock who are induced to spawn, and then we take care of their larvae while they're still in a plankton form, and then they settle on the bottom, and then we hopefully get them, you know, a 10% of them through to young adulthood. Here's a shot of one of our aquarists pulling a fecal sample from the tank so that we can keep track of the pathogens, make sure that the animals are in great shape, and also that if we are to introduce them to the wild, we aren't introducing them with pathogens that may then cause problems for those animals that are already out there that we put out there and any naturally occurring. It has been a stellar spring for the endangered white abalone. We have found 16 of them off of the Palos Verdes Peninsula, some of which in aggregations that are close enough where they might actually be able to functionally reproduce. That's decades since anybody's seen something like that. This is my soup to nuts, and another one of our employees at the Bay Foundation, he's out there with what he called the chop saw, you know, putting together the outplant modules that we use to bring these snails from the lab onto the boat, into the ocean, to the bottom of the ocean, and set them to their own direction after that. And the next two slides will give you some evidence of that. So this is a short little video. This is Santa Barbara last week, off the coast of Santa Barbara. And there is one of the red abalone making it out onto a giant kelp holdfast from one of our custom abalone tubes. I was thinking we need to get like sponsorship from like a lipstick company or something like that. They are. Everybody that works with the abalone in our lab have fallen completely in love with them. I don't know what to tell you about the riz that the abalone have, but it's there. Next slide, please. Oh, is that the next? Oh, here we go. Here it is. Right, we got other things to check on, and then you know we came back around like, oh, all right, still going. That animal is roughly an inch to 2 inches in size. Our target outplant size is right around an inch. They seem to be fairly resilient at that stage. All right, next slide. As for Mark's talk, barriers, we certainly know that there's lots of barriers that young people who are interested in marine sciences face. So part of the support of your decision making around this table has allowed funds to move forward to not just recruit, but to also train and now give folks their first job working as marine scientists. That was this morning. So the front row there, that's Cass and Leslie and Esteban. Leslie couldn't make it. She wasn't feeling up for the trip, but they're getting trained right now, working alongside the TBF dive team to do all this type of work that we're doing. And we're trying to make sure that we get a workforce here in LA that is representative of LA doing this work to improve and help out our coastline. I hope they had a good day. It was looking a little bumpy. As for the beach, so Dan was talking about the rocky reefs where the abalone are. Mark showed us, you know, any number of opportunities for us to better understand who is enjoying our beach. And what I'm trying to do is add to those activities, Mark. And this project of now establishing sand dunes across about 15% of Santa Monica State Beach in its entirety has involved hundreds of volunteers. We're going to need to make it to be hundreds of more in order to continue to maintain the inertia for this and the enthusiasm for it. And I really have had to strain stress with my staff that as much as this is about plants and killed deer and snowy plovers, it's more about people and making the beach a place where flowers grow, and that experience and that personal investment in I made those dunes happen is what we're striving for. Here's David, another staffer of ours. So we put some plants in the ground in February and watered them, and we were like, yeah, everything's going to be great. It's going to be a nice wet March, and they're going to do wonderful. I don't know if you all remember March, but it was 85 degrees and the sun was blasting down, and they just, so we did a lot of watering. We lost quite a few plants. And we got QR codes and Grow the Sand Dunes with us. The next couple slides will show you some of the other ways this is being applied. This specific dune polygon, pardon the jargon, is just over the border from Venice into Santa Monica, and it is in the shape of a medicine wheel, which is a very common Native American symbol. It's at the center of a lot of spiritual, a lot of aspects of ceremony and a spiritual identifier. It's a circle that has four spokes that are at the cardinal points, and it is, you know, worshiping the north, acknowledging these cardinal points and the things that are attributed to them. So here we are with a bunch of volunteers who are spreading seed into that medicine wheel. We're continuing to talk to local Native tribes as to how they may want to better represent their language, plants that they're interested, things like that moving forward. But please go down there and check it out. I also have a suspicion that the pagans are onto this for the solstice, and there might be some cool things going on Father's Day down there. And knowing that, and Mark's data spoke to it, that there are a sector of folks, a demographic, or, hey, I understand that sea level rise is coming. I feel like I'm tuned into something here to help. We also recognize that that's probably folks that are interested in environmental science or kind of environmental, but we weren't doing much to broaden that reach. So this is a short video. Imagine Restoration is the marketing campaign we're using in Santa Monica to get folks who maybe have more of an interest in art or visual graphics to say, why don't you come on down and, you know, become part of this as well. If the audio is on, the little girl in that fantastical pelican is, you know, laughing her and having a great time, and there's a dooty-dooty little fun music behind it. And Big Blue Bus, digital billboards, the city of Santa Monica has been terrific. there's so many partners involved in all this work. I knew I was going to skip over everybody and have LA County Beaches and Harbors, State Parks, Audubon. Whew, the lifeguards, if I didn't say it, have been central to this. Heal the Bay. Lots and lots of folks. Next slide, please. For those of you who use the bike path or the Strand down in Manhattan Beach, you may be familiar with the restoration work that's gone on there. The work that was conducted in 2026 in that area, 2025 into 2026, has earned Best Restored Beach Award, one of five in the country, by the American Shore and Beach Preservation Association. Thank you again to Beaches and Harbors for helping us approach this and get recognition for our collective work there. Very notably, a little early this year, the El Segundo blue butterflies are back again. By the hundreds, if not by the thousands. So that is an endangered species with a very small range that this project has been able to directly support. And I get goosebumps talking about it when we're working with generations of Angelinos going like, I didn't know flowers could grow on a beach. I didn't know butterflies could live on a beach. And really starting to change that perspective. Next slide, please. There's a very fuzzy salt marsh moth caterpillar crawling around on a plant in Manhattan Beach. And now our mature plants are producing enough seed that we're actually collecting seed from our restoration sites to generate the seed that we need to then create more sites. Folks elsewhere in the state of California whose jobs are to preserve the California floristic province are now coming to these sites to gather seed to genetic bank these plants so that they can survive the next 80 years if things go as badly as we anticipate in regards to climate. Next slide, please.
Tom, could you wrap up in a minute?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
I was fortunate enough, thanks Greg for having me down there. The Black Surfers Collective, we're training their instructors to get ready for Nick Gabaldon Day, which is a tremendous celebration on Santa Monica Beach. I was fortunate to be there hanging out. There's the instructors right there doing their briefing before getting in the water and actually exercising their techniques. And, you know, I've got a short attention span if it's not obvious. Next slide. And then I looked over to my left and saw this happening, which I had personally never witnessed. So those are snowy egrets picking off kelp flies on the beach in Dockweiler. And unfortunately, I had turned off my camera to see if I had caught the birds, because right out there, about another 100 yards past those waves, was a juvenile great white shark that breached. And it was somewhere between, I'd say, 5 to 8 feet, just jumped up in the air, big white belly. Wah! Boom, crashed back into the water. I'm looking over at the surf guys going like, oh, I guess they didn't see it. That's a little bit about what's going on out there. Thank you all. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom. So that brings us to item 2E, reports from members on implementation of comprehensive conservation and management plan goals and actions. This will be the opportunity to for any member to report on public engagement and tribal engagement if they have any. Are there any members that would like to speak? Yes, Erin?
I do. I just have a couple time-sensitive pieces of information. As you know, we're working on finalizing the recirculated draft EIR for Bayano Wetlands EIR, or Biolitis Ecologic Restoration Project. We are trying to get that EIR on the streets within the next month. I don't have an exact date yet. There's just things that are beyond my control. But if that is if that hits the streets in the next month, then that'll start a 45-day review period. And I welcome anyone's comments on that process. Just a reminder, though, that the scope of that recirculated draft EIR is just limited to the two sections of the document that were set aside during the litigation. So that is the entirety of it. And then the second item is that we're also working on finishing our land management plan for Biona, and we have a date of July 9th in the evening at the Westchester District 11 office for a public meeting on that process. So I just want to make sure everybody's aware of that timeline. And then I just want to say if anybody on, and if any of the members or anyone has any questions, or if anybody wants to meet with me or anyone else, just to let me know. And I welcome that. So that's it.
Thank you. Are there any other comments for 2E? Yes.
Yes, I had a couple slides that hopefully we can bring up. Presentation just from Black Surfers Collective, and I think it's really timely because of what we talked about with the resolution, and also with Beacon talking about access to the beach and what's going on. So I'll just give you a little brief idea of what Black Surfers Collective has had going on in the first couple months of the year and where we're headed.
I'm trying to get it. Could we get the? I'm trying to share my screen. Could we get it displayed on the TVs?
All
okay,
right.
Here we go. Let me start over.
Great. Not a problem. These first pictures are from Nick Abeldon Day. This was our 14th annual. We've been running this at Bay Street Beach at the historic Inkwell. Nick was a surfer in the late 40s and early 50s that was of Mexican-American and African-American descent. He was known to have paddled across the bay in the days of Jim Crow to Malibu to surf, which is where he actually passed away on a large day of surfing. But he surfed in the days of Gidget and Grig and all the greats of the original surfers of Malibu. And when we started the Nick Abeldon Day, when we started the Black Surfers Collective, we started with Nick Abeldon Day with the help of Heal the Bay, Santa Monica Conservancy, the City of Santa Monica, Surf Bus Foundation, and we've been growing ever since. We started off with maybe, you know, 5 boards and 10 participants, and now we had as many as 300 to 500 people show up this year, put about 120 people in the water, gave lessons. We actually do not only a historic lesson, but we talk to them about ocean ecology, about what happens at the beach, give them encouragement. We bring people from all over Los Angeles County to the beach so they can get an idea of, you know, many of these people we found that they don't even know, they live 5 miles inland, they haven't even been to the beach. So, and some of them don't even swim. So over the years, what we've done is we've expanded our programming to involve free swim lessons through park systems, through YMCAs. We have implemented different programs through the Bay Foundation, through other organizations to teach them about the ecology of the coastline, basically trying to build stewards of the land and the ocean, not just bring people to the beach. I mean, if they surf again, that's great. If they don't, I hope I've opened their eyes to what it is that the coastal areas have an opportunity to show them. And over the summer, we will move the rest of our events to Dockweiler Beach. Thank you, Mark. We will run programming through October, and hopefully, if the water stays warm, even later into the year. And it's just, it's what we do, and we hope to continue, and we'll probably put about 1,500 people in the water this year and give them the lessons on top of doing some beach cleanups and things like that. Also, the photos that you have here, we were invited up to Ocean Day, Ocean Day was June 6th of this year, and we got together with 300 other individuals from organizations and groups. We were split up into lobbying groups, and we moved around the Capitol to speak to representatives and their representatives about some of the bills that were coming through either in front of them at that time. Excuse me. Either in front of them at that time or bills that are coming up for vote. And these bills that we talked about were about offshore pipeline drilling, banning disposable vapes, which are ending up on the beaches, the chemicals, the plastics, expanding outdoor equity, which is very important to us, hydrogen sulfide standards, which are probably adding to the acidity and things in the ocean, and outdoor for all initiatives, codifying those and making sure that they are upheld. Also, there was a bill that we spoke against, which is a coastal development permit, which is right here in Santa Monica. They're trying to get a bill passed so they can have a bypass of some of the laws on development of the coastline. And so we're trying to make sure that those laws are upheld. This year actually was the anniversary, the 50th anniversary of the California Coastal Act and the Coastal Conservancy, and the 21st annual Ocean Day. So this was our first time being there. We were happy to be there, and we're gonna be there every year from now on. It was really amazing to be a part of that group. And so I just wanted to let you know some of the things that we're doing as Black Surfers Collective. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. Are there any final comments? Okay, then that wraps up our informational items. It brings us to item number 5 on the agenda. Other,
we still have to address item 3.
3A.
We do not have a quorum, so we cannot vote on the meeting minutes from April 16th. So I recommend we consider those at the next governing board meeting.
Okay. And so now that brings us to item number 5, closed session. There is no closed session item. Item 5B is member comment. Governing board members may comment on issues not on the agenda. Are there any comments from any of the commissioners? Seeing none. Brings us to item 5C, announcement of next meeting date. The next executive committee meeting will be held on July 16th. At the Edward C. Little Water Recycling Facility in the city of El Segundo. The next governing board meeting is set for August 20th here at the Delray Yacht Club. And last but not least, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.